This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, it's Friday and you know what that means. It's another episode of Good Things, the show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. I'm Dashran Johan and on the show with me today is Jason Wee, the co-founder of Architects of Diversity, a non-profit that runs unique programs designed for secondary school students in Malaysia to tackle the hard questions of living in a multicultural society. Welcome to the show, Jason. Good to have you on.
Thanks so much, Dashran. Good to be on.
Let's start right from the top. Tell me a little bit about Architects of Diversity.
Well, Architects of Diversity was founded sometime in 2018. We started off as a short course where we brought around 31 students from all over Malaysia together for a week-long program of empathy and conflict resolution. We started off as a group of United World College alumni that sought to brought United World College mission, which is using education as a force for peace and a sustainable future, and apply it to the Malaysian context. And since then, we've grown into a team of over 2,000 staff, interns, and volunteers, where we bring people from different backgrounds and communities and create different kinds of spaces for better interaction. AOD's motto is essentially that we want to bridge communities and identity groups among youth in Malaysia. And what we aim to do is that we want to use these spaces to create the kinds of tools and equip youth with tools for better peace, justice, and a sustainable future.
And Jason, what inspired you to start Architects of Diversity? And more, to be more specific, I'm also curious, what inspired you to focus on this particular cause, you know, diversity? Why does it mean so much to you?
Yeah, I think personally, I grew up in, you know, a very relatively diverse background.
Right.
I went to SK Taman Mega, which is one of, you know, the, I guess you could say the most diverse primary schools in Malaysia, where I was surrounded with peers from, you know, different backgrounds. And I also went to a United World College in Costa Rica, where I was surrounded by peers, you know, from 80 different countries. And we lived in really small communities. And, you know, these, I contrast these spaces with the, you know, the larger community I'm part of, which is, you know, my country, which is the world. And there are such stark differences between the communities I'm in. And I asked myself, you know, what made these spaces so different? And I think on a more personal level, I really had a great time in these spaces where I could ask myself, you know, where could I be who I am and what kind of spaces could allow me the space to grow into the person I want to be. And that's very much intertwined with identity, right? What kinds of spaces allow us to break free of the identities we're in? And that's so much interlinked with the issue of diversity. And so for me, I think I had the privilege to grow up in these spaces. And it pains me that a lot of Malaysian youth do not have access to these spaces.
Right.
And there are so little opportunities to enter these spaces. And I felt a very large, you know, sense of purpose and to some extent guilt that with this privilege, I should be able to create more opportunities and pass the baton down for future generations.
Jason, let's talk about why there's a lack of these spaces, right? Because it's been about six decades now since we achieved independence. Yet our country over the past few decades seems to be becoming increasingly polarized, especially across racial and religious lines. What do you think we did wrong as a nation?
So that's an interesting question, right? Because we know that the lines have always been there. These lines have been established pre-independence. They were established for hundreds of years by British bureaucracy and colonization. And when we talk about spaces, right, space is such an interesting thing. What does it mean? It means the people that we're interacting with. It means the territories we can cross. It means who we consider ourselves to be a part of our community. And so when we talk about, you know, from independence until now, and we talk about increased polarization, I think that might be a misnomer to some extent. While it is true that we might feel that there's increased polarization across racial and religious lines,
right,
I feel it's almost just more of an exposure of lines that have already been drawn. Because since I think independence, you know, the kind of treaties or compromise that we sought was a trade-off, that we had contrasting and conflicting needs and demands coming up from different communities, that the kinds of social structures and agreements and the norms that we set out in independence was a trade-off. It was trading off. We wanted stability, but at the same time, we got a lot of unreconciled tensions in our communities, right? Mm-hmm. We saw, obviously, May 15, 1969, where those tensions surfaced and manifested in violent ways. We are tense now, in my opinion, because those basic tenets where we set up our country are being tested. And I think, in my opinion, we don't have the tools or structures to appropriately deal with them. When I mean tools or structures, it's the ability to engage in these tensions in a constructive manner. Mm. For a lot of times, you know, with the draconian laws that have been set in place on speech, the kinds of culture that we have permitted to go on for so long that have, you know, deterred people from discussing these things in the open have, you know, essentially stripped us from the ability to engage meaningfully with these topics that are so divisive, such as education policies, such as religious grounds, et cetera, et cetera. And when we don't have these tools, what happens is that when we are not engaging them constructively, that's why we feel that there's increased polarization, because people are not engaging constructively. I think the other, you know, conflation is that conflict is bad, because I don't think conflict is bad. Conflict is useful to clarify, right, and it's useful to move us forward to a more just position. But when we don't have the tools to engage with those, you know, discourse constructively, then what happens is we end up defaulting to a less productive state, and when you create, you know, unproductive conflict. And so I think where we went wrong is that we had all these unreconciled tensions in the past, but we had no preparation whatsoever to deal with them because we kind of shoved it under the rug. And so right now, I think we're dealing with those consequences and we need to address them quite urgently.
That's a very interesting point you brought up, this idea that these lines have existed for a long time during the colonial era. And this reminds me of something that an anthropologist from the UM was telling me a few weeks ago. And he mentioned that Malaysia is a post-colonial country that hasn't actually dealt with its post-colonial identity crisis. Do we even have a Malaysian identity? Like, how do you process this?
I think, well, with the limited interpretation I have, you know, I'll very much agree that I think during colonial times, what was set in place was the idea of groups. And groups and how those groups are solidified in our Malaysian psyche, the ways we characterize communities and the way we use our language, right? When we say Malay, Chinese, Indian, Lion, even these categories itself are colonial constructs. And I think, in my opinion, we haven't dealt with the question that when can we move away from these group labels? And I think that's why we are feeling that we are living in some, you know, colonial hangover. And I don't mean this question in like a colorblind way, right? Because we're definitely not at a place where we should say, I don't see race, when race has permeated and continues to permeate in so many corners of society. Mm-hmm. But I think my question moves more closely to, in order to move away from these racial categories, how can we appropriately correct for the deficiencies of both British and modern policies, especially post-1969, right? Mm-hmm. And so then we haven't even started to ask a question, you know, what are the benchmarks that we should use that we can say, okay, it is time to move forward from these racial categories and move to, I know, this idea of what it means to be Malaysian. Because when you say, you know, we don't have a singular Malaysian identity, I think that's, you know, somewhat correct. And I think, for many good reasons, maybe certain minority groups are unwilling to buy into this construct of what Malaysian is, or some majority groups have different ideas of what it means Malaysian because we haven't reconciled those tensions yet. I mean, even in the US, there is no singular idea, you know, for what it means to be American. And that's always contested as well. Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly fine. But I think that very common platform of engaging in the discourse of what it means to be a certain thing, that's what's important. And because we haven't even started to ask the question, you know, when can we move away from the groups that we're in, then we don't have the, you know, the tool set the toolkit to even begin to question what does it mean to be Malaysian? Because even the language that most of us use right now, what it means to be Malaysian, we're multicultural, you know, Malay, Chinese, Indian, blah, blah, blah. It's essentially quite essentialist. It boxes people into certain groups that doesn't take into account that, you know, racial boundaries are a constructed truth rather than an objective truth. And so until we like get to that point where we can properly set those benchmarks in our public policy, then I don't think we can move forward with this kind of colonial hangover. Professor Lee Hock Wan does this, you know, quite immensely with the kinds of affirmative action policies that are taking place right now, that, you know, we haven't even begin to talk about whether the policies we have in place that were initially set out to correct deficiencies and inequalities are working as it is. And until we are dealing, you know, obviously there are many limitations to this, with the majority of them being political. There are, you know, intricate political incentives that have been produced by the kinds of policies that were set out in the past. And because of that, that kind of stymies us away from moving forward the conversation. And there are obviously laws that prevent us from even discussing it further. So in some ways, yes, we are dealing with a post-colonial hangover, in my opinion, that's very much, the undercurrent of it is these categories that we're still operating with. But we have to operate with them for now. And I think that's a very, you know, nuanced position to take where, yeah, you know, we want to acknowledge these categories, but at the same time, like, we know they're not true. And yes, that's a difficult narrative to push on.
On the show with me today is Jason Wee, co-founder of Architects of Diversity. After the break, I'll be asking him about Malaysia's post-colonial identity and some of the programs he's been running with Architects of Diversity. We'll be back on Good Things, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Jason Wee, co-founder of Architects of Diversity, a non-profit that runs unique programs designed for secondary school students in Malaysia to tackle the hard questions of living in a multicultural society. So Jason, how do we begin to talk about racism in Malaysia? Because there is so many layers to it, right? I think the most simplistic, just really simplistic example is that even when we talk about the privilege of the majority, in Malaysia, the majority can simply point to the top 10 richest people in Malaysia, the list, and say, do you see us represented in the list? Which is an incredibly valid point. But at the same time in Malaysia, right, minorities, for example, the Indian community, face very real struggles of their own, whether it's just individual implicit bias or systemic racism as a whole. So how do we even start to tackle this?
Yeah, so I think I'll say two things to this. So I think the first thing is that there are many layers to it. And at least how AOD goes about talking about it is really interrogating what is identity to you. So what does it mean to be Indian and what does it mean to be Malay or Chinese or whatever race you belong to? Mm-hmm. And these conversations are difficult because they're slightly existential, right? Do you come first? Are you somebody that exists outside your racial category? Can you be that person? And talking about that very identity is, at least in our toolbox, is one of the most useful ways to move forward with identity, because we perceive race to be something so fixed rather than constructed. I think that's, you know, one of the most important fundamentals that we need to talk about, especially within the circles we're in. Mm-hmm. But I think secondly, I think when we talk about racism, right, and I think you're very right to say that it's so complicated in Malaysia. And I think it's because race and power in Malaysia is precisely difficult to draw clear lines. And it is essentially very complex. Because unlike the United States or, you know, many countries, we have an unclear picture of power and groups. And I would say that we simply don't have the data to talk about power. And I think I want to point specifically to the between Malay and Chinese communities in an accurate manner, right?
Right.
For example, the data released by most government agencies cluster Bumiputras. So we don't have, you know, good differentiating data between Malay and East Malaysians, for example. Mm. So what this produces is that we have data that doesn't point to correct groups, and we have communities that feel victimized because to some extent they are. I don't know how you know, oftentimes Malay communities compared to Chinese communities in terms of economic welfare. But we do know, for example, by far that Indians and other minorities have it far worse, both politically and economically. And why this, you know, picture of race gets so conflated is because I think we have this, you know, high-standing conflict between Malay and Chinese communities that have, on one hand, been characterized as Malay holding political power and the Chinese as holding economic power. But even then, I don't think the picture is as clean-cut. And because power is spread out in, you know, both halved and also complicated manners, we cannot accurately say who has the power here. And when we want to address, okay, this is racism, you are an oppressor or something of, you know, or referring to some structure of power, those structures of power is becoming incredibly blurred. And so where do we start is, you know, on one hand, I think we should definitely release the data. but, you know, I don't know if that's happening anytime soon.
Right.
But where I think, you know, given the constraints we have, where should we start is addressing the fundamental perceptions of what it means to be in a certain community. Because I think even when we're both speaking like this, we're both speaking English, which even puts us in a very privileged place.
Right.
In Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes when we talk about power, we don't account for these factors. And so I think how we should approach the conversation about racism and privilege is from an empathy standpoint. When we don't have, you know, the systems or legal environment to even talk about it, but what we can do is to approach it from an individual standpoint, where empathy helps us move forward from a place of being part of a group to being part of a collective of individuals. And I think that's a very seismic shift that's really, really difficult to achieve from time to time. To some extent, you know, in AOD, in our programs, we do this when we set up basic tenets that we want to achieve, right? Where we establish safe spaces, where we look at vulnerability to engage genuine connections. And I know this sounds very, you know, kumbaya, where we're talking about empathy and individual connections, but the kumbaya does do the heavy lifting, if done correctly. The evidence coming out from research abroad especially shows that empathy is a great way to move individuals from towards a more just position, a more egalitarian positions. And I think we don't this, you know, we say kumbaya in Malaysia, but we don't do this well enough. So many kids I've met are incredibly emotionally constipated to some extent. We aren't given the space in schools. Teachers tell us to be quiet in class, where we don't have the ability to engage in the genuine connections that move us to a point of empathy that helps us see beyond structures of race and privilege and even see through these structures for what they are. And so, you know, we hope that the empathy and connections we facilitate building in our programs helps change the idea of what an in-group is for our participants and blur the lines between what is us and what is them, while acknowledging that these are constructed truths to be reckoned with.
Okay, so tell me about some of the programs that you run. Because, of course, you know, racism is complex. Multiculturalism is a difficult thing to maneuver. So how do you attempt to create a space or spaces for young people of various races to come together and understand our differences, but not in a colorblind way, like you mentioned, right? Because these problems are real. How do you get them to address the issues in a very real way? Tell me about your programs.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for me, I've facilitated so many sessions before. Mm-hmm. And my favorite thing to do in these sessions, be it, you know, being a one-day program or a seven-day program, is that we need to set the norms of the group. And I think this isn't talked enough that what we perceive to be acceptable and what we perceive to be egregious in our communities really sets the tone for how communities engage within the community. So in research for intergroup contact, where, you know, we have different groups coming together, what are the sort of conditions that we need to create in these groups in order to facilitate better interactions that help us move to a more just position? And in research, you know, we have four basic tenets that we try our best to implement in our programs, which is one, that we set equal group status within the situation. That is, groups perceive each other to be of equal standing, where no group has an advantage over the other. Second is that we have common goals. So this is your typical working together towards a like a working together activity, team building. The third thing is intergroup cooperation, where they're working together in non-competitive ways. And the last one, I think this is important, is authority support, where the facilitators or the organizers are endorsing interactions of varied manners. And I think with these, you know, elements, what we do is we create life-size, life-like simulations for our participants, where we're replicating certain conditions that exist in the real world and say, okay, these are circumstances that you live, we live with outside. How would you engage with them without the pressure that comes with the kinds of sensitivities we have to navigate in Malaysia? So for example, in one of our simulations that we conducted in our short course back in January this year, which was online, we had all the participants, you know, placed into different parties and stakeholders to discuss what it means to have Bumiputra quotas in education. And it's very tense, obviously, and they have to argue from different sides when they're placed into positions where they're not comfortable with or they don't agree with. But having them take the perspective of a position that's not theirs helps them see from the other side. Right. And that's not to say that we're justifying the positions of all sides, because I don't want to go, you know, all sides, you know, listen to all sides.
Yep.
But these are tools that to perspective take, to see from the other side. These are tools to effectively equip them with the kinds of mindsets and the kinds of emotional intelligence to deal with how other people are, where other people are coming from. The third thing is that we intentionally instill conflict within our groups.
Right.
And we as Malaysians, I think, deal with conflict all the time. But, you know, as we see in politics, there's obviously a lot of conflict. But how do we deal with them in an engaging manner? It's a different question. So, for example, one of our activities, we put them in a a zero-sum game where they have irreconcilable conflicts. So very much like Parliament, where they have an open floor, they end up screaming at each other. They end up fighting. Some of them end up crying. You know, these are these are pathologies that are common to Malaysian discourse, especially mm-hmm. we see in our highest chambers of power. But what we give space for is that we ask them to deal with this in a constructive manner. So once you scream, once you shout, once you fight, how do you move forward from there? And so it's a lot of rebuilding. It's very challenging for a lot of our participants, which you know, we don't have that space for in many places, and we hope to expand these spaces.
Sounds very, your programs sound very intriguing. Do you have any memorable or heartwarming moments from running these various programs over the past few years?
Yeah. I think, you know, in the most recent program that is to do with secondary school students, because we do run various sorts of programs, that in our recent short course that we had to move online, we had skits on different social issues. So participants, you know, put on a bad and good skit where we address, you know, issues of discrimination, and in this case, mental health. And what people, you know, think about communities of support is that, you know, we talk about things and then kind of go away. In this particular session that we had, where it was a kind of around day three and participants were engaged for a long period of time at this point, where somebody, you know, started to share their experiences of depression and other serious cases, where without even being prompted, our participants supported each other, you know, through Zoom chat to have words of encouragement and even self-disclose issues they've been facing themselves.
Oh, wow. That's really nice.
Yeah. And it's amazing to see, you know, that one, I think it's very hopeful that, you know, yeah. youth that are so aware of this, but at the same time, that these spaces can be built. It's like, they're not, you know, it's not rocket science to some extent. we talk about, you know, building communities, like we have to like spend so much money in on pouring money in, but really it's the ability to hold that space for these young individuals in saying you can support each other. And creating that system of support, you know, might sound, again, very kumbaya, but it really does, you know, egg at these structures, you know, and these lines that we've drawn between different groups that say, although we speak different languages, that we are a community of support. And those very you know, mental processes that I will support you and you will support me does a lot of the hard work of bridging different groups that we want to talk about.
Jason, many of us can be, you know, very pessimistic about Malaysia's future sometimes. I mean, you see it on social media, you hear it in Mama and all that, right? Like these conversations about the bleakness of Malaysia's future, especially given how polarized we are, you know, across racial and religious lines. But you actually run programs, like you were talking to me about, with young people on embracing diversity. When you work with these young people, are you hopeful about our future?
Well, I think I have to be hopeful. If not, you know, I think I quit my job. You know, that would be just so sad. But no. I digress. I think working with young people, I think it really dawns on you that the seriousness of how malleable society is to change. It really dawns on us. I kind of sit onto it every day, and every session I run with young people, that I walk out feeling refreshed. And I think all kind of sides of whatever spectrum, you know, left, right, up, down, conservative, liberal, all sides realize the malleability of how malleability of young people. And that's why I think, you know, the education system is so incredibly guarded. But I think I still remain hopeful that we already find that many of the participants we come across are already at point B, where they are already engaged in these issues, where the world is changing and young people are exposed to media and social media that's doing a lot of heavy lifting about educating and bringing these issues to their consciousness. And I think as, you know, I'm borderline millennial, Gen Z, I think I'll categorize myself as millennial, where older generations before me made grand promises about what the world could be, where many of my generation and younger arrived instead at a vision of a world that is completely different to theirs, right?
That's right.
So I think for me, I'm hopeful because we're starting to see tension. And of course there's tension, but this tension is good because it means that the status quo is being challenged. And I think, you know, there are many, you know, the youth movement in Malaysia is at its peak in Malaysia right now. We are seeing unprecedented sorts of political awareness among young Malaysians, where I think we are realizing that that although there are like polarizations happening across different lines, that we're addressing the fundamental systems that prevent us from talking about it in the first place. And so I am hopeful because of the communities I've met. I know this is not representative, and it is almost like a race to reach as many people as you can, especially with young Malaysians. And I think that's why, you know, at least for me, living in Malaysia right now is so exciting, because we are at kind of this segue, or we are coming to this crossroads where some balls are rolling. And I'm excited to see where those balls land and to see how Malaysia turns out in the next 10 years.
All right. So, Jason, as we wrap up this conversation, do you all have any upcoming projects that you'd like to highlight, programs that you're working on, or even how can people who are interested in engaging with you all get in touch?
Yeah. So I think for now, for at least the next few months, Architects of Diversity is very focused on our Sekolah Semua campaign, which is an anti-discrimination education campaign. We talk about, you know, unity and peace, but what must come first before unity and peace is justice. And so this campaign really starts to tackle discrimination that's based on identity. So, you know, race, religion, gender, and all these kinds of, you know, identity-based discrimination that happens in our school. And we saw, you know, Make Schools a Safer Place movement that happened about, you know, sexual harassment and abuse. But there's also a huge such a suffering that's yet to be unearthed within our education system. So our Sekolah Semua is our Sekolah Semua campaign is currently ongoing. If you are a member of the public, feel free, you know, to go to our website, sekolahsemua.my, to report the kinds of discriminations that you faced in your life before. And if you're a student, we currently have our program Duta that's open for applications if you're 16 to 25. If you want to be part of a movement to challenge and inspire our education system to be a safer place for all identities, then yeah, do join us and speak up about the kinds of discrimination that's been going on for so long, but we haven't talked about in our own communities.
Fantastic. And on that note, thanks so much for speaking with me today, Jason.
All right, thanks so much, Darshan, for having me.
That was Jason Wee, co-founder of Architects of Diversity. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Good Things on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.